This week marked the 150th birthday of one of America's best-loved authors. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we celebrate Laura Ingalls Wilder, the author of the popular series Little House on the Prairie, which traced her family's travels across the Midwest, including 2 years in the Kansas Territory near what is now Independence, Kansas. The books were the basis for the popular television show Little House on the Prairie, which aired in the 1970s. Wendy McClure retraced the life and travels of Laura Ingalls Wilder, churning her own butter, grinding her own wheat, all while wearing a calico bonnet. She's the author of The Wilder Life, My Adventure in the Lost World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. I visited with Wendy McClure at the Johnson County Public Library. This interview originally aired in 2011. How did you come to revisit the whole Little House on the Prairie scene?
Well, first I had to reread the books, which I didn't do for over 30 years. I sort of came across the first book accidentally after it turned up in my parents' garage when they were having a moving sale. And so I reread Little House in the Big Woods. I was really reluctant to revisit the books, actually, because I'm a children's book editor, and I was always sort of afraid that it wouldn't hold up. You read a lot of historical fiction when you're an editor, and you get used to sort of what the genres are. And I think I was just really worried that it wouldn't be as wonderful as I remembered. But then when I read Little House in the Big Woods, it really was. So I was telling my boyfriend Chris, like, these books are, you know, this book is so great. And a couple weeks later, he came home with a box set of the Reader's Digest blue paperbacks of the Little House books. And I thought at the time, actually, well, that's nice. I'm not gonna reread all of them at once. But then I did.
You didn't just read them. You became kind of obsessed with world. How did that happen?
Well, I think it was sort of my natural, you know, sort of adult curiosity. At the same time I was reading the books, I was also looking things up on the internet. There were, you know, just a sort of a new world sort of opened up to me. You know, when you're older and you're able to sort of look at things more critically, and also just say, like, hey, okay, what really is going on in Wisconsin? You know, can I go there? And I found out when I started doing a little research that indeed you could go to all these places. I didn't know that as a kid. So that really sort of struck me right away. And then I also just became really preoccupied with the idea of, okay, I kind of want to recreate some of this stuff. I want to see what it's like to make long winter bread. I want to see what it's like to churn butter. And I found out soon enough that there was a wonderful book out there called The Little House Cookbook by Barbara Walker, who also, I mean, I really have to credit her with the instinct of going back and recreating all these things. And that's just such a wonderful way to engage with the books. So I got that cookbook, and I did lots of things. So.
Wendy, can I have you read from the very beginning of the book?
Okay. I was born in 1867 in a log cabin in Wisconsin, and maybe you were too. We lived with our family in the Big Woods, and then we all traveled in a covered wagon to Indian Territory, where Pa built us another house out on high land where the prairie grasses swayed, right? We remember the strangest things, the way rabbits and wild hens and snakes raced past the cabin to escape a prairie fire, or else how it felt when the head of a needle slipped through a hole in the thimble and stuck us hard, and we wanted to yell, but we didn't. We moved on to Minnesota, then South Dakota. I swear to God it's true, we were a girl named Laura, who lived and grew up and grew old and passed on, and then she became a part of us somehow. She existed fully formed in our heads, her memories swimming around in our brains with our own. Or that's how it felt to me, at least. That's how it still feels sometimes, if I really think about it. I mean, I don't believe in reincarnation, and obviously Laura Ingalls Wilder didn't either, not with her respectable Protestant singing off-key and wooden churches upbringing. It's just how reading the Little House books was for me as a kid. They gave me the uncanny sense that I'd experienced everything she had, that I had nearly drowned in the same flooded creek, endured the grasshopper plague of 1875 and lived through the hard winter. It's a classic childhood delusion, I know, and in my typically dippy way, I tended to believe that the fantasy was mine alone and that this magical past life business was between Laura and me and no one else. Surely I was the only one who had this profound mind meld with her that allowed me to feel her phantom pigtails tugging at my scalp. I had to be the only one who was into the books that much. And, oh my God, I wanted to live in one room with my whole family and have a pathetic corncob doll all my own. I wanted to wear a calico sunbonnet. Or rather, I wanted to not wear a calico sunbonnet, the way Laura did, letting it hang down her back by its ties. I wanted to do chores because of these books. Carry water, churn butter, make head cheese. I wanted dead rabbits brought home for supper. I wanted to go out into the backyard and just, I don't know, grab stuff off trees or uproot things from the ground and bring it all inside in a basket and have my parents say, "My land, what a harvest." There were a host of other things from the books that I remember I wanted to do too, such as make candy by pouring syrup in the snow, make bullets by pouring lead, sew a seam with tiny and perfectly straight stitches, have a man's hand span my corseted waist, which at the time didn't seem creepy at all, twist hay into sticks, eat salt pork, eat fat pork, keep a suckling pig as a pet, chase a horse and or ox into a barn stall, ride on the back of a pony just by hanging on to its mane, feel the Chinook wind. It's not that I really wanted to make bullets or race around on ponies. It's just that I wanted to be in Laura World and do them.
You just described my own childhood perfectly. Because I remember reading those books and thinking, gosh, why don't we have corncob dolls anymore? And while something as mundane as making my own bed or setting the table for our family dinner didn't seem like an exciting chore, somehow going out and fetching water did seem so.
Somehow our suburban childhoods just seem so unsatisfying after reading those books, and I don't know really exactly what it is.
As someone who edits children's books for a living, do you think that this is an indication of how well-written the Little House books are, that it pulls you into this world in a sort of magical way that...
I think so, definitely. You know, there's a lot of historical fiction out there that really sort of gives you... It's the literary equivalent of a historical village. And, you know, and even though Laura certainly did that in the books by giving these wonderfully detailed procedural passages about churning butter or how to make smoked venison or making cheese or any of those things, there was just also something about the perspective that was so immediate. You weren't really reading just about a character. You were really with Laura. It was just the point of view. You really felt like you were in her head. And I think that's the writing.
So in your recreation of Laura World, you churned your own butter. Mm-hmm. You grinded your own
Wheat.
You bought numerous sunbonnets. Yeah. You camped out in a wagon. You did all kinds of things that Laura would have done in probably a slightly more authentic fashion.
Right.
At any point, did your family say, you know, Wendy, I think you're going too far with this?
Well, it should be said that I didn't do, you know, anything really truly immersive. And actually, I think it was never the point to, you know, to do some sort of off-the-grid experiment to, you know, live in a cabin without electricity, because that would have seemed like an endurance event. And the Ingalls family, they just lived. They didn't endure. You know, our worlds are so different, and I understand that. And to do something like that would be, like I said, about something else. But I like just sort of doing these little things, and they were just kind of like little portals, you know, into these moments in the books. So, you know, I think people were pretty supportive of it. You know, Chris, my fiance, you know, helped grind the wheat with me. And I mean, there was always the acknowledgement that this was a little weird what we were doing.
Okay, speaking of Chris, I have to say, in reading this book, by the end of it, I loved Chris.
He's great. Yeah,
okay, describe the scene where you guys are camping out in the wagon, because that's probably my favorite. Yeah.
So out in DeSmet, South Dakota, there's a place called Ingalls Homestead, which is actually the Ingalls Homestead land. And one of the things you can do is spend the night in a sort of modified sheep herder's wagon that looks like a sort of a fiberglass covered wagon with a wooden wagon bed. And it's like a very crude camper inside. And we spent the night in there, and it was kind of a rainy night. And
kind of a rainy night.
Well, then because, you know, there was the rain, and then there was hail. You could hear it on the hard top. And really one of the most spectacular lightning storms ever. And we were very aware of the fact that we're in this little wooden box. There's an electrical hookup right beneath us. There's an outlet in the ground right beneath us. There's little metal bolts, you know, holding the fiberglass top on.
The only thing you're missing really is a lightning rod.
And, you know, we were thinking so many different things. We thought, we're going to die. We thought, what's going to happen to the wheat? Because there was this beautiful wheat field out there, and then there was a hailstorm. And so, of course, something always happens to the wheat in the Little House books. So, lightning struck nearby. It was really, it was quite an experience. And, everyone thinks that, you go out sort of, seeking adventure like that. But, we kind of got it in spades that night. And we're like, this is more than we asked for.
And when it was all over, Chris said, whoa, what about the crops?
Right, yeah.
Easily, I think, the funniest line in the whole book.
Yeah. The first thing the next morning we did is we got up and we went over. The wheat was fine, it turned out, but
but it did give you probably a sense of how delicate that balance
is. Yeah, yeah.
And that at any moment that crop could be gone.
Right. Yeah.
And there goes your livelihood for the year.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that I think you and I have in common is that we both loved these books as a kid and didn't actually watch the TV show.
Right.
And I'm guessing that many of our listeners did fall in love with the series of books initially, I'm guessing that there's also a pretty good contingent of people that came to the books through the TV show.
Definitely.
Tell me why it is in your circumstances that you didn't watch the TV show as a kid.
Oh, it's really funny. When I was looking back and first starting to do all this research, I was wondering, I love those books. Why didn't I ever watch the TV show? And I went back and I looked at the TV schedule from something like 1981 and realized that Little House on the Prairie was in the same time slot as WKRP in Cincinnati, which is the show my family watched.
And one of my favorites, yeah, I have to say, as someone who works in the radio business.
Yeah. So instead of family-friendly programming, we saw, we watched Lonnie Anderson and Howard Hessman.
But now that you did reveal kind of an uncomfortable tension between followers of the TV show and the authenticity of the book.
There's always a little dance when you are first talking to someone and you say you're a fan of Little House on the Prairie, and they say, I'm a fan of Little House on the Prairie too, and you sort of have to feel each other out to make sure you're talking about the same Little House on the Prairie. Because if they start saying, oh, that episode where Albert was addicted to morphine, and then they're very disappointed that that didn't happen in the books. And you have to say, are you kidding? At the same time, I was really surprised at how many people really love the books and the TV series equally. That was, there are definitely purists. There are definitely people who say, I don't accept the TV show at all. But there are a lot of people who understand that they're two different things and love them both. And that kind of surprised me.
One thing that really surprised me in reading your book was the attraction that the whole Little House on the Prairie world holds for people who homeschool.
Yeah. Well, there's a homeschool curriculum that's based on Little House on the Prairie, so that's definitely part of it. And as far as living history, the books are really wonderful for that, with all kinds of hands-on stuff that you can do that really lends itself to homeschools. But yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely a segment of the population out there who have a dissatisfaction with the modern world, I guess, and then the Little House books, that world becomes really idealized to them. And I think, you know, in sort of returning to, you know, the Little House books, you know, as a curriculum, you know, it's sort of their way of embracing that.
I don't know that she set out to create this idealized world, that there are issues that she raises that maybe in the TV show were kind of glossed over a little bit, or maybe not, actually. I shouldn't say that since I didn't watch the TV show, but do you think, I realize I'm asking you to sort of go out of your head, but do you think Laura Ingalls Wilder would be surprised to sort of we see her world in some kind of idealized way? Or do you think that was maybe her intention in writing the books?
There was definitely a little bit of an agenda, and that was both on her part and then Rose, her daughter, who helped her with the books. I mean, you know, they definitely presented a picture of a family always sort of heroically moving westward, when in reality, they didn't, you know, they didn't quite do that. They backtracked sometimes. Sometimes they fell on hard times and had to live with other family members or give up farming and do something else. There's a whole period of a couple of years that Laura didn't put in the books where they lived in Baroque, Iowa, and they ran a hotel.
And a kind of seedy hotel
Yeah, and, you know, having to deal with travelers. There was a bar room. There was a saloon next door. And I don't think the family liked it very much, but they sort of did it to get by. And it's really interesting, knowing that, then going back to read the Little House books, there's a scene in a little town on the prairie where there's talk about Laura going into town and maybe working, and Ma says, well, not in a hotel. And it's really interesting that, you know, she has Ma saying that, considering, you know, in real life, she was working in a hotel when she was 10 years old.
And it was not a very pleasant
experience.
No.
So there was definitely some glossing over. And there was definitely also a little bit of a political ideology, just, you know, the sense of people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Also omitted from the series is any mention of them getting government assistance, when in reality, Mary got funding to attend the Iowa College of the Blind. So, you know, those things were sort of deliberate choices, and the books were definitely crafted. Though I think I don't know what she would think about the sort of family values. I mean, she might not disapprove, I guess. But it's a somewhat different agenda than I think what Laura and Rose put out. Not that much different, but a little bit.
Well, of course, since you're in Kansas right now, the part that will probably be the most interesting to our listeners is the part where they're in Kansas. And I was surprised in reading your book that it's a little unclear where exactly they are.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what happens when they get to Kansas?
Well, there's what the book tells you, and then there's real life. In real life, Pa seems to have been very deliberately squatting on Osage Reserve land, and probably in the hopes of getting cheap land, anticipating that eventually the land would be open for homesteading. So that's the reality. In the book, they're going out, and there's a much more ambiguous situation where it's a really interesting sort of nuanced portrayal, I think more so than a lot of people like to think. There's definitely multiple perspectives. There's the neighbors who you know, who feel the Indians just need to be driven out altogether, or worse, just eliminated. And then there's Pa, who has a more tolerant point of view. And then there's Laura, who sort of asks the obvious question, which is, why are we on their land anyway? Why do they have to move west when it's their land? And, you know, it's a very pointed question. And I think, you know, for all the legitimate criticism the book has for its portrayal of Native Americans, I think that it was good that she posed that question. And then the way the book sort of resolves it is, a soldier comes out and tells Pa that he just sort of happened to be, you know, over the line.
Oops.
And that it's some sort of government, you know, bureaucratic mix-up. And so in the end, the government's to blame. Hmm. And it's sort of interesting because it's, you know, through all this, there's all this ambiguity, but then at the end, they just blame the government, which is, you know, kind of funny. In reality, I think they're not quite sure why the Ingalls family left the territory, but one thing that is true is that they had sold the cabin in Pepin, Wisconsin, to go down to Missouri and then Kansas, and then the man who had bought the cabin from them couldn't keep making payments, so they realized that there was a chance to go back and reclaim that cabin. So that was probably one of the reasons why they went back. And then there were also definitely rumors that the government was going to come and kick them off the land, but there was never, I think, a case of a soldier coming and asking them to leave.
There was also a little bit of confusion in sort of the, I want to say this, where exactly are they and the distances between, like, how close they are mm-hmm. to Independence, Kansas?
In the book, Laura says that they settled 40 miles from Independence. In reality, as they discovered in the 1960s when they researched land records and compared them with census records, they were 14 miles away. So they think that Laura had misheard the story or misremembered. And so it's really interesting if you look at some of the earlier editions of the books and you look at the flap copy, they say that they're in Oklahoma, because that would have been 40 miles from Independence, and it's also where Indian Territory was.
Sure.
So that was a really sort of interesting little footnote there. So Laura didn't even really know where the site was herself. She went looking around Oklahoma for it at one point in 1930 or so, but no one really knew where they were until they did this research in the 1960s, which actually is also when they found out, when they began to discover that the books, they were based on real events, but there was a lot more fiction to them, because when they finally added up the years and did the math, Laura would have been like 2.5, 3 years old at the time, not the older child that she is in reality in the books.
Wendy, can I have you read from the part where they're actually in Kansas and where you're going to visit her site in Kansas?
Okay. The Little House on the Prairie replica cabin gets an A for authenticity. A+, really. The Big Woods cabin we'd seen in Wisconsin had been a tidy, splinterless affair constructed by professionals. The Kansas cabin looked like it had been built by, well, Pa. The walls were made of spindly, unstripped logs with peeling bark. The corner joists were ragged. The cracks between the logs were filled in with crumbling clay. I'd read it had been built following Laura's descriptions as closely as possible. Certainly the door looked like it had been made per the descriptions in the book, with its elaborate latch descriptions to that this day I can never figure out. First he hewed a short, thick piece of oak, the book says. From one side of this, in the middle, he cut a wide, deep notch. He pegged the stick to the inside of the door, up and down and near the edge. He put the notch side against the door so that the notch made a little slot. Somehow it's so specific it's disorienting. One side in the middle, up and down and near the edge. Every time I read this passage, I follow along as best as I can and then get completely lost. But to look at the door, or its facsimile thereof, you'd never guess it could sound so complicated. I felt both stupid and relieved to see how it works. You pull this little rope, and then this thing goes up. The doorway was low. I had to duck a little to go inside. The cabin was furnished somewhat. There was a primitive bed with a quilt, some rough wooden furniture, a table with a red checked cloth on it, just like Ma had used, and a guestbook for visitors. The mantel held a glass oil lamp and a china shepherdess, both of them glued in place, and there were a couple of enamelware pots on the hearth. None of it felt terribly lived in. Something like this could only gesture toward hominess. But I liked being there. It felt, in fact, like a playhouse. I wanted to just sit there for a while, Maybe it would rain again, and I could listen to the rain on the roof. But the rain had stopped for the most part, and I could see out the door that two other cars had pulled up along the fence. I went back to explore the rest of the place. Behind the tiny post office, which I found out had once served Wayside, Kansas, were a couple of little printed signs on slightly crooked posts, and beyond them lay the open space of the prairie. One sign indicated that Dr. George Tan, the black doctor who treated the Ingalls family during the fever and ague chapter of the book, had lived somewhere off in the distance across where the highway now ran. The other sign simply said, "Look north," and visualized covered wagons coming over the Kansas prairie.
When you were in locations like that, could you just look north and visualize covered wagons coming over the prairie?
For the most part, I think one of the wonderful things about seeing these home sites is that the landscape is still very much the same. And you have to sort of give Pa credit for that. He really never liked to be anywhere where it was crowded. And so none of these home sites, they're all off the beaten path. There's no risk of suburban encroachment or anything like that. So it's still very much the same.
So you went to all these different Laura Ingalls Wilder sites throughout the Midwest. Do you have a favorite or a favorite experience at one of them?
One favorite experience is when Chris and I went to Pepin, Wisconsin. That was the very first site we went to. And I couldn't wait to get started. So we went in the beginning of March. I thought it'd be cool to sort of see these places in different seasons. And so we went, and there's not that much there. There's a little museum there. Of course, it was closed for the season. There was a cabin. You could go inside the cabin, but it's sort of empty inside. But then we went to see Lake Pepin, which is a lake on the Mississippi River. And it was still completely frozen. It had something like 2 feet of ice. And I realized that it was the same time of year that the Ingalls family had driven across that lake to get to Minnesota at the beginning of Little House on the Prairie. And you just could just sort of look across and see the bank in the mist. And I just had this sort of feeling that if you just went across, you would actually sort of be back in Minnesota, and you would be on their journey, and you'd be in 1870, and that was a really wonderful experience, and it was something that I hadn't really expected. I thought, like, oh, it'll be nice to be in the log cabin, but this was something that was really wonderful, and it was a really great way to start my whole journey.
Of all the Laura World experiences that I wish I had had as a kid, the one that I always wish that I could have replicated was living in a sod house.
The actual sod house where the Ingalls family lived is now sort of just a depression in the ground. It's caved in, but it's right on the banks of Plum Creek. And except for the fact that it's just a dip in the ground, it still looks very much like you would imagine it. And it's from that depression that they can see how big it actually was. So and when you go into town in Walnut Grove, and then also in DeSmet, you can see these replica dugouts, and they're tiny. They're like a freight elevator inside. And it kind of changes the story for you when you realize that, the scene where they're making the button string for Carrie and trying to keep it from her, they just had to turn their backs and in a corner. There was no other part of the room that they could go in. So it starts to seem kind of absurd, that was sort of one case where, I feel like my book memories make more sense than the reality.
Wendy, I've marked one passage that I'd really like for you to close on. Can you kind of set up where you are right now and what's about to happen?
Well, at this point we were in South Dakota, and we were looking at driving around, looking at the homestead land and all the places where they'd been, and there were some replica shanties where they'd lived on the Ingalls homestead land. But we'd sort of seen everything we could that day. We were driving around. We'd seen the lake. where Laura and Almanzo had gone riding in their buggy. We'd seen the cemetery. We'd seen all kinds of things. And then we drove a little bit north of town to see the place where the book The First 4 Years had taken place, and which was, there was really nothing there now. But I just, it was such a strange time. I was feeling really sort of vigilant, just driving around and just needing to take it all in. And it was really sort of starting to not get to me, but, I was really, really searching. After turning back north, we finally pulled off the road by the historical marker that designated the low, empty hill behind it as Rose Wilder Lane's birthplace, the site where the Wilder claim shanty had stood. We sat in the car and ate our sandwiches, staring west at the scrubby cow pasture where Laura and Almanzo had lived their luckless existence. But it was also beautiful. There were no trees here. It looked the way the country must have looked when the railroad first came through here. Ever since yesterday, when we'd watched the pageant, I'd had the feeling that there were two worlds here, one layered upon the other, and that everyone who came here was always trying to see through one prairie to the other.
Wendy, to me, that perfectly summarizes exactly what you were doing in writing this book and going on this adventure.
Yeah, it was.
Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, this week marked the 150th birthday of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the author of the popular series Little House on the Prairie. I've been visiting with Wendy McClure. She's the author of The Wilder Life, My Adventures in the Lost World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. She tweets as Halfpint Ingalls. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. We've got more KPR Presents coming up, but first, a song inspired by Laura Ingalls Wilder and perhaps her time here in Kansas. This is The Big Sunflower by Douglas B. Green from Happy Land, musical tributes to Laura Ingalls Wilder.
There is a charm I can't explain about a girl I've seen. My heart beats fast when she goes past in a dark dress trimmed in green. Her eyes are bright as evening stars, so loving and so shy. And the folks all stop and look around whenever she goes by. Oh, I am as happy as a big sunflower that nods and bends in the breezes. And my heart is as light as the wind that blows the leaves from off the trees. As days passed on and we became like friends of olden times, I thought the question I would pop and ask her to be mine. But the answer I received next day, how could she treat me so? Instead of being mine for life, she simply answered,
no.
I went next day dressed in my best, this young girl for to see, to ask her if she would explain why she had shaken me. She said she really felt quite sad to cause me such distress, and when I said, won't you be mine, of course she answered,
yes.
Oh, I am as happy as a big sunflower that nods and bends in the breezes. And my heart is as light as the winds that blow the leaves from off the trees.
That That's The Big Sunflower by Douglas B. Green from the album Happy Land, Musical Tributes to Laura Ingalls Wilder. This week marked the 150th birthday of Laura Ingalls Wilder, author of the popular series A Little House on the Prairie. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.